Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams from Utah Public Radio. How the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints could have a say in the Great Salt Lake's survival. Utah students barked like dogs at Asian American and Polynesian basketball players. And officials gear up to again promote crosswalk flags in Salt Lake City, but some question how effective they are. Those are some of the stories we'll be following today. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Reporter Courtney Tanner, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Also, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins is with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And news columnist Robert Gerke providing commentary throughout the program. Robert Gerke, thank you.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Good to be with this all-star cast.
It's a great cast, that's right. And good to be with everybody today. Let's start with Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. You, along with Peggy Fletcher-Stack, have an interesting story this week about how the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints could prevent its headquarters from becoming a toxic wasteland. That's reading the headline. Subheadline, Utah's predominant faith has a huge stake and could have a huge say in Salt Lake, Great Salt Lake's survival. So you talked to a lot of people, covered what the church is doing right now with conservation, what environmentalists suggest they could do, and interestingly, you get into cultural influence and even theology as well. So, Leah Larson, I guess maybe the first question, Governor Cox says he's meeting with leaders of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Do we know anything about that meeting or those meetings?
No, we don't. You know, I've been asking him about this since, like, I think July. And he said, you know, because they kind of are the elephant in the room when we talk about these issues. They own a lot of land in Utah and the Great Salt Lake Basin, a lot of water rights. And, you know, this is like the headquarters of their faith. So they have a big role to play. So the legislature enabled water rights holders to lease their water to like benefit environmental uses like the Great Salt Lake. So it just kind of followed in my mind, at least, that, well, the church would be a great entity to talk to about this. So are you talking about it? And the governor says that, yes, those discussions are happening, but we're not seeing any movement so far. I'm not sure where things stand.
So we know the church does own some of the oldest water rights. I mean, understandably, you went on some investigation. What have you come up with in terms of the extent of those water rights and how much water the church owns?
Yeah, so this is so tricky to nail down, not just the water rights that they hold, but also the land they own, just because the church has so many real estate arms and so many entities under its, like, umbrella, its corporate umbrella, I guess. But we did our best. We filed a records request with the Division of Water Rights, and what we came up was 75,000 acre feet, I believe, and 600 cubic feet per second. And I know that number just makes people's eyes glaze over. Like, what does that mean? So just to kind of put it in context, studies have found that the Great Salt Lake is short about like 1.2 million acre feet. To put that number into context. So it might sound like a drop, but every drop helps. And it's probably an underestimate of how much they actually hold. That's where we landed with the water rights. And, you know, like I said, they probably own a lot more than we were able to uncover. But I think their influence extends beyond just the water rights they own. We can talk about that more if you want.
First of all, legislators have, as I'm just quoting you here, legislators have retooled Utah's pioneer era water rules so that right holders can lease their water to benefit the environment. But, you know, a lot of water rights holders are reluctant. They still feel like maybe I'm going to lose my rights, right, if I let it be used. So far as we know, that also includes the Latter-day Saints.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's a bit more complex than concerns over that they might lose water rights. I think some farmers are worried that, a lot of the land that maybe they're growing hay on to operate their dairy operation is leased. And so if their landlord finds this leasing prospect more attractive, more lucrative, that might put them in a tight spot where they don't have enough feed for their herds. So it's just really complex. And, you know, their concerns are certainly valid. This is new. This is like a big experiment in a lot of ways. But I do think that's where the church could play another role in just reassuring people, because, you know, a lot of the farmers in the state and in the Great Salt Lake Basin are members of the church. So they do have a lot of influence that way, I would say.
You talked to many people for this story, including Brigham Young University professor Ben Abbott, who's famous as kind of the lead investigator on the Abbott report recently. What does he say about this? Particularly, you brought this up, the church, he says, could have an influence in maybe persuading farmers to use this program the legislature set up.
Yeah, Ben has been a great source for this reporting. Like you said, he's a BYU professor, so he works directly for an institution owned by the church. I think one of the interesting points that he's made is that the church's own word of wisdom, its own doctrine, says to eat meat sparingly, like in times of famine only. And so if you think about what are farmers growing in the state of Utah and in the Great Salt Lake Basin, it's mostly alfalfa. That's where a lot of our water is going. And I know people are frustrated with that. They're like, why should I conserve at home when farmers are growing all this alfalfa? But I would ask those people to consider, like, how many hamburgers do you eat in a week? Maybe if we cut back our meat consumption, it could move the dial in a big way on where this water is going and what farmers are growing. I think that was one of his really interesting insights.
Tell me a little bit more about that. I think, you know, the church's word of wisdom, you think about prohibition on alcohol, coffee and tea, for example.
Oh, for sure. I think that's like what the church is known for, right? They don't drink alcohol, they don't drink coffee, they don't drink tea. But, you know, within this same doctrine is that meat thing I just shared, and that doesn't seem to be followed to the extent that the coffee alcohol thing is, but it's in there. It's in the same doctrine. So, I mean, it's an interesting point. I think Ben Abbott, we had him on the Mormonland podcast this week, and I got a guest host that, and he said that he felt like, you know, what divine inspiration that, you know, when the pioneers were like settling in the Salt Lake Valley, they weren't really facing that kind of famine. They had plenty of resources to go around. So just like the kind of foresight of you know, where we're at today, it's so interesting that it's in their doctrine.
So under the heading of cultural influence that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints could have, you do quote from a news release that was issued, I think it was last year, from the church?
Yeah. So they've issued this news release 2 years in a row, actually, just highlighting what they're doing to cut back their water consumption. And I think they said, like, I'm just going off memory here, but like they've saved like 30 million gallons. But somebody did the math, and that's only like 90 acre feet, which, you know, putting in context, it sounds good. And then you put it in context, and it's like, well, that's kind of a drop. But, you know, I think, like, in my neighborhood, the church property, their lawn went totally brown and dry this summer. And I think that is a great way to signal a message to members and like community members, just how dire things are. But the other thing we observed is this doesn't seem to be enforced consistently across all church properties. Like, for example, the lawn at the property in my neighborhood was brown, but then I could go like the next neighborhood over and it stayed green all year. So I think just more consistency in enforcing this, and like, why not embrace like our Great Basin desert landscape? And maybe we don't need grass at these church owned properties. Like, that could be a great way to signal a cultural shift in Utah. Just a few examples.
So you're saying the church could set an even better example, I guess, go zero scaping or whatever it is at their buildings. In this press release, the church points out that, or they claim they have reduced water usage on their properties by one third.
Yeah, but the thing that I struggle with these press releases is like, they don't cite any specific examples. They don't cite any targets or goals. Like, so you've conserved water on one third of your properties. Is that in Utah? Is that across all your property ownerships? Because, you know, they own property all over the United States. So I just wish they would be like more specific. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Let's see, you quote Soren Simonsen. Soren Simonsen has at least three recommendations. For the church.
That was Peggy's interview.
That was Peggy's interview. Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
I just quote this here. Lose the lawns, he says. that's what you were talking about. If the church is not using water rights, should funnel those shares back into rivers and streams and be an advocate for Latter-day Saints doing the same, be part of the solution.
Yeah. Yep. I think those are all good points. Sorry, the challenges of a co-by-leg story, right?
But right.
Yeah.
This may also be part of Peggy's part, but the story quotes some past and current leaders on, President Spencer W. Kimball was very environmentally minded. He's quoted as saying, Presiding Bishop Gerard Cossey recently came out with a speech that Latter-day Saints should be environmental stewards. His counselor, Bishop Todd Budge, similar message. And President Alan Oakes has recently talked about climate change.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's important. It's great that they're sending that messaging out there. I just think it would be helpful if they, again, would be more specific. Like, why not mention the Great Salt Lake? It is at the heart of your church headquarters. It's kind of part of your cultural fabric and history. You know, we've all heard the story about the gulls that ate the Mormon crickets and then flew over the Great Salt Lake. And, I wish they would just embrace this particular issue a little more vocally, I guess.
In the story, you quote Brigham Daniels, who's an environmental lawyer. He says the church's general response to drought is to pray for rain. He's saying, well, maybe we ought to expand that. You change our behavior, right?
Yeah, I mean, such a good point. Even our own governor a couple years ago, made this heavily produced video calling on people to pray for rain. It doesn't seem like it's working. We've had a good winter, a lot of moisture, a lot of snow, but one good winter is not going to pull us out of this problem. And, the overall trend is one of drying with climate change and everything. So I don't think that we should fully depend on magical thinking, I guess. We got to start taking action. The Great Salt Lake Strike Force came out just this week with a report saying as much. Like, we're going to have to endure a bit of pain and a bit of cultural shift and mindset and how we think about water if we want to solve not just issues in the Great Salt Lake Basin, but the Colorado Basin and throughout the West.
Anything else you'd like to say about this story? Then we'll get Robert's commentary, and I'd like to treat at least one other story that you've done this week, Leah.
I don't think so. You covered the points very well.
Okay. Robert Gerke, what do you think about this story?
Well, I think I was really happy to see this story because it's something I've been thinking about for a long time is who are the biggest water users? I mean, if you're looking to actually conserve a lot of water, it makes sense to go to the ones who are using the most. And it stands to reason that the LDS Church is up there. I think that, but it's also really hard to get at this information, as Leah was mentioning, because it is so scattered and held through so many different holding companies and so forth. That said, I mean, it does highlight that, there are these big water users in the state that need to be serious about this. And, some credit obviously goes to the church for the steps they've taken. Are there more? There probably are more steps all of us could take. So I think it's encouraging. I think it's important to focus on this. I hope that this is just the beginning of the church's efforts in this front, because, as you mentioned, they can not only do it themselves, but they can also, sort of set an example for, the million or so members million plus members they have around the state. And so I think, we'll keep an eye on this. And I think there's probably other similar large water users out there who can, also follow this lead and take these steps. So, it's going to take everybody doing a little, but those who can do a lot, I think, are obligated to do a lot.
So, Lee Larson, I want to talk about another of your stories, and this pertains to Great Salt Lake as well, came out this past week, about Native American representation on boards and such. They're being consulted about policy regarding the Great Salt Lake. So tell me a little bit about this.
Yeah, and thank you for calling attention to this issue. So if you think back to Speaker Brad Wilson's big legislation from last year, it was this Great Salt Lake Trust, $40 million that went to this trust to secure water rights for the Great Salt Lake and to kind of repair the watershed. So last week they announced that they had formed their advisory board that's gonna kind of consult them on how to spend this money. So, you know, trust is finally getting moving along. And they had, you know, diverse stakeholder representation on this board, which, you know, agriculture, conservation groups, brine shrimp harvesters, mineral harvesters. But on this board, as with many committees that represent the lake's interests and provide an advisory role, there is no seat at the table for Native tribes. And Northwestern Shoshone member Darren Perry, he went to Twitter and just kind of vented this frustration a little bit, noting that, you know, his ancestors have managed this resource pretty sustainably for thousands of years, and why are they never included on these kinds of panels? So I think it was an interesting point that he made, and I was really grateful he was willing to talk to me about it.
What do state leaders say? Any plans to include Native voices on any of these panels?
I don't know that there are plans, but I think they sort of acknowledge that, oops, that was an oversight. They certainly, their voice should be heard on these important issues. But I haven't seen any movement that they're going to restructure the boards or anything.
You talked to Weber State University professor Sarah Dant, I believe, for this story. She was... I think she was pretty firm on we need Native voices here.
Oh, for sure. And she's a well of knowledge. It was a great source for the story. But I mean, it's about time that we start acknowledging this, right? Like, we've kind of erased tribal voices from a lot of these conversations about natural resource management. It's like we pretend they're a relic of the past and they're not still here with, you know, active cultures and active insights on these issues. So only just recently are we starting to include them. The tribes were consulted pretty heavily, for example, on the establishment of the Bears Ears National Monument. And they co-managed that with the federal government, which is like a big, big step, she pointed out. I had the opportunity to go to California a few months ago and go see Owens Lake, which a lot of people cite as like the worst case scenario for the Great Salt Lake. You know, it dried up and turned into this terrible source of dust, and people kind of like just pass it off as like a dead lake, like a wasteland, but there's still an active tribal member representation there, and, you know, they'll point out that it's not dead, it's still alive and it still has value, and they actually persuaded the state to name it as a historic district and recognize its value. So, you know, maybe it's time Utah catches up with some of those conversations.
We're out of time, so for this segment, so I'll just point people to your story. You had another story. You were quite busy this week about Governor Cox ordering the Great Salt Lake Causeway to be raised again in order to keep separation between the two arms of the lake, right? And one arm is very, very salty, we don't want the other arm, I guess, to be to reach lethal levels.
Right.
And there are trade-offs and there are problems there, but anyway, we'll point people to that story. Thanks, Leah Larson. Appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you.
Leah Larson, Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter. So before we go to a break, Robert Gerke, anything you'd like to say about tribal representation on these panels regarding Great Salt Lake?
I guess it's not super surprising that the tribes have been shut out of these, just because that's sort of the pattern that we've seen. And we've seen this happen in other states where tribes have had to make a lot of noise in order to be included in the discussions about, you know, Colorado River water and so forth. And, you know, if you think about it, we put all of this stock in who holds the most senior, the oldest water rights. And, you know, as Darren points out in the story, these tribes have been using this water for millennia, you know, and so to not include them in the conversation, I think, is a real disservice. And hopefully, you know, because of the attention that people like Leah and Darren are bringing to it. You know, we'll see that start to change because, yeah, they do need a seat at the table. They do have a stake in this and should have a voice.
Well, you are listening to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams from Utah Public Radio. Coming up on the program, we'll hear next after break how Utah students barked like dogs at Asian American and Polynesian basketball players. Later in the program, officials are gearing up to again promote crosswalk flags in Salt Lake City. Some are questioning how effective they are. And we'll have the underplayed stories of the week as well. More following this break.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams from Utah Public Radio. We bring in now Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. So I want to turn to your story. The headline is Utah students barked like dogs at Asian American and Polynesian basketball players. I think what's being alleged here is racist slurs, right? So tell me which high schools are involved and what's been happening.
Right. So this was a game that happened on January 13th between Roy High School and Hunter High School. It was played at Roy High School, which is, you know, a little bit more north of Salt Lake City. And so essentially the Hunter High School team is a pretty diverse team. It's from Granite School District, which is one of the most diverse districts in the state. And so, you know, its team represents that. And they went to play at Roy High School and alleged that the student section at Roy High School was essentially taunting its diverse players, particularly its Asian American and its Polynesian players, barking at them. Some slurs were used, and it's not the first time it's happened.
So what, I guess, what kinds of slurs and what, why do the parents, at least, of these Hunter High players think that these were racial slurs?
So the main thing was the barking. So the Roy High student section was barking, and it really seemed targeted to these Asian American and Polynesian players. You know, we watched several videos at the Tribune about this, and it does kind of heat up or get more intense when the Asian American and Polynesian players are on the court. And, you know, you kind of think, oh, it's barking. How is that racist? Well, you know, these parents point to what happened last year at the same school when the Roy High students were calling the Hunter players dog eaters, which is obviously a derogatory racial slur. And so the barking kind of follows that same name without essentially saying those words. In addition to that, the Asian American players this year were told to go home and eat more rice, which is, again, obviously a slur. And, you know, there was targeting towards some of the other players too, some of the Latino players, a biracial player. And there was some mocking of what's called the haka, which is a Polynesian or a Maori dance. So kind of targeting players based on their skin color.
I don't know if you were able to talk to any students. I know you did talk to parents.
Mostly parents, yeah.
Yeah.
The students are kind of afraid to talk at this point. They play, it was yesterday. They played Roy again yesterday. And so a lot of them were just afraid to speak up and be targeted more, essentially.
Do we know if anything happened in that game last night?
So nothing that I'm aware of, but it does appear that Roy High School is taking action. And essentially, Roy High School is saying, you know, we need to investigate this. We're not sure if it's racism, but it does appear like they're taking action now to stop the student section from kind of any chanting or noise making, I guess, if you want to call it that. And then they're having them sit higher up on the bleachers, essentially, like as a punishment. They can't sit kind of on the front row of a game now.
So I guess the evidence of some action happening, I guess the running theme through your story is Hunter High parents were complaining that they brought this to the attention of whoever they could bring it to in administration, and they feel like not enough action has been happening.
There's a lot of concern from parents that their concerns, you know, weren't being heard, weren't being addressed. You know, like I said, this happened last year too. And these parents say, look, you know, we went to the administrators at Roy High. We went to the administrators at the Utah High School Activities Association last year, and we heard silence. And then it happens again this year. And there's this frustration that was like, you know, look, we brought this to your attention and you didn't act on it. And now it's happening again. And so this year, again, you know, they've talked to Roy High administrators. Some of the parents went up to Roy High administrators during the game and were kind of told, you know, we're not hearing anything. We don't know what you're saying. And so there is this kind of frustration that they're just being brushed off after bringing it to everyone they can think of.
One of the things you try to investigate and the parents are trying to figure out is who's responsible. Seems like agencies are kind of pointing the finger at each other.
That's right. It's, you know, that meme with the Spider-Man where they're all pointing at each other. It's kind of like that situation, right? So, you know, Roy High is saying, like, we'll look into it, but, like, we're not really sure what we can do. And Hunter High is saying, you know, they're not our students. We can't discipline them. Like, we're turning the investigation, obviously, to Roy. And then the Utah High School Activities Association, which governs, you know, governs high school sports in Utah, is essentially saying, you know, it's up to the high schools. But the High School Activities Association is what sets the standards for sportsmanship in games. And so it is kind of this, who is supposed to be acting here and why is there no action?
One of the factors here that I guess stood out to me, you said Roy High does have a percentage of, you know, diverse population of students. Hunter, it's even bigger, right? It's double. But Roy does have a significant population of diversity.
Right. And what's interesting is, you know, some of the Hunter parents were saying, you know, we can't believe that Roy High students are doing this when they have diverse players on their own team. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, Granite is one of the most diverse districts in the entire state. It has a majority minority population. 55% of its students are students of color. And Hunter High is even a little bit higher. It's almost 70%. But if you look at Weber School District, you know, you go down to 20% of its student body is students of color. So it's, you know, there is this disparity between the two and the populations there.
It was interesting. You quote one of the parents as saying that the taunting, the slurs got worse after COVID-19. More taunts toward those of Asian American descent.
That's right. And that comes from Granite School District and essentially saying, you know, there's been this nationwide trend of kind of hatred directed toward Asian Americans. And we've essentially seen that in a smaller version in a microcosm in this school district.
What are the Hunter High parents saying they want? What does they most want?
I think the biggest thing is a clear process, right? I mean, they've essentially tried to address these concerns through multiple administrators at multiple, you know, agencies and felt like they've kind of been dismissed. And so I think their biggest ask is just for some kind of set process for handling concerns of racism and reports that come in.
Anything else you'd like to say about the story?
I think that covers it. I guess one thing is that Roy and Hunter aren't in the same region next year, so they won't play again. But these parents are concerned about any school that plays Roy and just wanting to address the concerns.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I want to get Robert's commentary on this, and then I want to come back and talk about another story that you had this week, Courtney Tanner. So, Robert Gerke, what do you think about this story?
Yeah, I mean, this story made me pretty angry, to be honest. Because, as you know, when it happens and isn't dealt with in a meaningful fashion and then happens again, you know, that's not a failure of some bad apples. You know, these are not just some kids who are acting out. This is a failure of administration to do what it's supposed to do and make sure that, you know, that kids aren't subjected to that. And they shouldn't be subjected to that, obviously. You know, so I think there's got to be some hard action taken. And if that means, you know, I hate punishing a team because of the behavior of its fans. We've seen that happen before where fans have acted out and made the team look bad. It's not necessarily the team's fault from what we've seen, but But at some point, you know, you either have to start having the team forfeiting games or fans excluded from games, or, you know, there's got to be some harder action taken to make sure that this doesn't happen again. You can't just laugh it off if it's a repeated pattern of behavior that's not being dealt with by the administrators whose job it is to do that. So, you know, it's, you know, they say sports builds character, but I don't think that necessarily holds true of fans in all cases. And in this case, you know, good for the parents for demanding some, you know, some response. It's unfortunate that it takes so much for them to get it, and that their sons in this case are, you know, being subjected to this kind of hatred, and you know, and shame on the parents of these kids who are doing this too, for not stepping in and, you know, taking action too. I mean, at some point you've raised a rotten kid and you need to be held responsible as well.
Courtney Tanner, I'd like to talk about another story that was published of yours in the Tribune. By the way, sltrib.com to go to view these stories. So I'll just read the headline. Newly released photo appears to show Gabby Petito documenting her injuries before talking to Moab police. You know, the famous case nationally. But remind us, who was Gabby Petito and what happened in general?
Right. Gabby Petito was this young Instagram influencer who was traveling across the country with her fiance, Brian Laundrie. Utahns will know this because of this police stop in Moab, but essentially what happened is, you know, they pass through Moab or stop by police, and then they continue traveling on, and Petito is murdered by Brian Laundrie.
So the news here is there's a photo that's been released. Tell me about this photo.
So yeah, Gabby and Brian were stopped in Moab on August 12th, 2021. I always have to think about that date. Essentially, someone had witnessed Brian Laundrie hitting Gabby Petito, and they called police about it. And what's interesting is this photo was found on Gabby's phone by her parents and the attorneys representing her family, that essentially is a selfie that Gabby Petito took just right before this caller called 911. So it appears to essentially be Gabby Petito taking this photo to document the injuries from this 911 call that someone had witnessed.
I believe there's a lawsuit against the Moab police, right?
That's right. The parents are suing Moab police right now, saying, you know, officers had an opportunity to step in and to understand that Gabby Petito was, you know, the victim of domestic violence, and they didn't act.
How could this photo, you know, fit in here? Is this another piece of evidence that, you know, against the police?
It's definitely, it bolsters the family's case, right? So, I mean, you have this 911 caller say they'd witnessed Brian Laundrie hitting Gabby Petito, and this photo essentially shows that that's what happened, and it shows that Gabby Petito was trying to document something. It appears, you know, that she's trying to document domestic violence. We don't know if this, you know, the first time that Laundrie may have hit her or not, but that she's aware of what's happening. So it definitely bolsters the family's case.
Apparently, according to your story, when police encounter her, she does not accuse her boyfriend of slapping her, but she does demonstrate how he put his hand on her face. Tell me about that.
So she says essentially, yeah, that Brian Laundrie had grabbed her face and scratched her, which the photo shows, you know, a pretty good scratch under her eye and blood smeared across her face. And so, you know, it's essentially proving what she told police. And then she also displays, and you can watch this in the body camera footage that police released, that Brian Laundrie grabbed her to where it would have covered her mouth. In Utah law, that's considered strangulation. Anything that covers the mouth, you know, even if it's not, you know, hands all around someone's neck, which is what I think most people generally think of with strangulation, covering an airway is still considered the same thing and is prosecuted the same in Utah. And so, you know, these domestic violence experts that I talked to said that police should have recognized that as one of the most red flags or, you know, the biggest signs of domestic violence, that essentially she was being strangled in this relationship.
Yeah, you talked to several domestic violence experts. What else are they saying about this?
What's interesting to me is I talked to Jen Oxborough, who's, you know, a licensed clinical social worker here and really a longtime victim advocate. She used to head the Utah Domestic Violence Coalition. She talks a lot about how victims document the injuries to kind of prove to themselves what's happening, which is just an interesting pattern with domestic violence. Essentially, victims feel gaslit often in relationships because it's a cyclical pattern, right? An abuser is often very nice and then abusive and then nice again. And so victims kind of can feel like they don't really know what's going on. You know, does he love me? Does he not? You know, and taking a photo like what Gabby Petito did in this case, according to Jen Oxborough, is this kind of way to keep your foot on the ground to kind of keep you settled so you know the reality of your relationship.
You talked to, or you have a quote in here from Joe Bianco, former detective. He talks about the body cam footage, I think, and the interaction. What does he say? What does he say the police should have done? I guess it's instructive for all police who are interacting with potential domestic violence victims.
He accuses Moab police of essentially never making Gabby Petito comfortable enough to open up about what was really happening. So essentially, you know, he thinks that Gabby Petito might have told them about this photo that she had taken, you know, 8 minutes before they started talking to the couple, you know, documenting her injuries, but that she never felt comfortable enough with the police to do that. You know, they didn't really give her any space to kind of collect herself, to open up. They were really kind of quick and brusque with her. And they ask her this kind of question that stands out now, that if the officer should tell Brian Laundrie that she loved him. You know, they're separating them for the night and they kind of ask her, do you want us to tell your boyfriend that you love him? You know, so it didn't really give her a chance to open up about being a victim, according to this police officer.
You point out that the parents, Gabby Petito's parents, were recently in Utah to speak in favor of Senate Bill 117. Tell me about this bill.
So this bill creates a database for police officers to look at past domestic violence incidents and also calls to police, even if those calls don't lead to charges. And then it also would require police to ask a series of questions, which is referred to as a lethality assessment program. Essentially, it's just checking to see kind of if someone's at risk for danger in a relationship.
Anything else you'd like to say about the story?
I think the big thing would be to just direct any folks that, you know, are experiencing intimate partner violence or know someone who are, to contact the Utah Domestic Violence Link line. And that number is 1-800-897-5465.
All right. I'll include, you have this in your story, Utah Rape and Sexual Assault Crisis Line, 801-736-4356. Courtney Tanner, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
So, Robert Gerke, what do you think about this story?
I mean, it's kind of heartbreaking in a lot of ways, I think, because we see this time and again when action is taken, but it's taken too late. And I think, you know, this photo kind of draws attention to the fact that there needs to be some sort of set standards of conduct or set standards for investigating these kind of crimes of domestic violence. And as Courtney mentioned, that's part of the bill that's making its way through the legislative session. I guess hopefully in the future, this type of thing doesn't slip through the cracks or, you know, become subject of shoddy police work that ends up in a tragic ending. But it's kind of jarring to see the photo too. I mean, we've seen the body cam footage, I think, in the past. You don't really see the full scope of the injuries that she'd suffered at his hands. And it's unfortunate the police didn't recognize that and didn't do what they were supposed to do. So, you know, I guess hopefully that if we want to look on the bright side in the future, that maybe these things won't slip through the cracks. But in this case, it did. And it ended in the worst imaginable way. So it's unfortunate and jarring, I guess.
Well, you are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams from Utah Public Radio. Following a break, we'll bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins and talk about those crosswalk flags. I think many of us have seen them. Some of you may have used those. Salt Lake City is looking to bring those back or reemphasize those, and we'll talk about are they effective or not following a break.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams from Utah Public Radio. We bring in now Salt Lake Tribune reporter Peyton Harkins. Peyton Harkins, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, as I teased before the break, crosswalk flags. Apparently, Salt Lake City is looking to, I guess, bring those back or reemphasize those. Maybe for those who don't, not a lot in our audience who won't be familiar with these, but probably some towns don't have these. Describe what these are.
Yes, so they're basically, if you're in downtown Salt Lake City and you go to one of the crosswalks across, you know, like a wide swath of the street, you'll see, often a, crosswalk indicate like a sign, and then adhered to the sign is going to be this little like cup holder-esque bucket that often will have orange flags in it. And the idea is that you grab one of these flags, in addition to maybe pressing the button on the crosswalk that, lights the beacons or whatever to let cars know that you're by, and you cross the street holding the flag just to give, drivers an extra bit of fluorescence to see you and stop, basically. And these, these exist outside of Salt Lake City too, by the way, but yeah.
Yeah, they're here in Logan where I am as well. Yeah. I've seen them elsewhere. So I guess one of the reasons to look for something to reemphasize these flags, as you point out in your story, it's become increasingly dangerous to walk or bike in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, we started the year off Martin Luther King Jr. weekend. There was a series of crashes, including two school children who were on their way to school and were walking in a crosswalk. And, this comes after another series of crashes in May. And, the city has been, putting forth a lot of effort to make its streets safer. They did the, reducing speed limits on local streets down to 20. And they have the livable streets program in the works, and all this stuff. But, in the meantime, the streets are dangerous and pedestrians are kind of facing the brunt of it. And so, these flags have been around 20 years, but the program had kind of, lapsed a little bit. Maybe they weren't keeping as close an eye on it or promoting as much as they wanted to. And so it's kind of in line with these other efforts. They've decided to reinvest in the program, and so they're trying to promote it more. They're trying to also go and see which registered crosswalk locations actually have flags in them. Because, in my old neighborhood, I just moved, but in my old neighborhood, kind of in the Sugar House, Liberty Wells area, I would go and try to cross the street and my crosswalk flag buckets would be empty. So.
And one of the factors here is Salt Lake City's famously wide streets, right? I guess on Eastern Street, you can cross quicker. Salt Lake City streets are pretty wide.
Yeah. And it's interesting because Salt Lake City actually got the idea from Ketchum, Idaho. And when I was talking to one of the transportation engineers, I just asked okay, so how do Ketchum, Idaho's streets compare to Salt Lake City? And it's like, ours are wider by far.
So there are some critics of these flags. What do they say?
Yeah, so I talked to Sweet Streets, which is this like transportation and pedestrian advocacy organization in Salt Lake City. And then I also talked to a professor up at the U. And, when I was talking to Sweet Streets, they were telling me that they obviously don't love the flags. They would like the streets to be safe enough that people didn't need flags to walk across them. But they also said, if the flags make you feel safer, they probably don't do much harm. Go ahead and use them. But, obviously they would like, more robust infrastructure that would actually work to slow cars and make streets safer, as opposed to, putting the onus on a driver seeing the flag and stopping for them, And then the U professor that I talked to, Reed Ewing, he
literally wrote the book on traffic calming, the books he wrote too on traffic calming. And he was telling me, you know, he lives by a series of these flags and, you know, has never seen people use them. And so he wonders how effective they are, and also just has the science to back up his, you know, claims that, you know, speed humps, speed bumps, roundabouts, reducing street lanes, you know, have a physical effect on slowing the driver down and therefore make intersections safer every single time. Whereas crosswalk flags, it's kind of the onus on, you know, the pedestrian to pick up the flag and the driver to see it and stop.
He talks about hawk signals. What are hawk signals? That's another method that could be used, I guess, is being used some places.
Yeah, and you can see those have kind of appeared throughout Salt Lake City. They're the kind of overhanging lights over the road where a pedestrian hits a button. The light shifts to yellow and cars are supposed to slow, and then it shifts to red and cars are supposed to stop, and, you know, the pedestrian walks through it, and then they'll switch to like the flashing red where the cars are supposed to stop, and then, you know, you look and see if a pedestrian is there and go forward. And so those, you know, in the study that the city provided me from, I think, 2006, you know, those had a 90 plus compliance rate with drivers stopping. So, you know, they're one of the most effective ways to keep pedestrians crossing the road safe, but they also have like a $100K to $150K price tag. And so, you know, Salt Lake City's perspective is that these flags have a, I think it was like 65% on average percent effective rate, you know, and they also cost, you know, hundreds of dollars compared to hundreds of thousands. And so, you know, they like those odds and cost effective measures and stuff like that. But yeah, hawk signals are definitely more effective, just several times more costly.
What do pedestrians say? I think you talked to several pedestrians.
Yeah, I put out a call on Twitter just to see how people interact with these flags. And I got a lot of people who kind of resented them. You know, a lot of people that found them a little bit offensive, didn't want to use them because they, you know, it's kind of the same reasoning I said before. They don't want to have to use them. But then, you know, I spoke to some people and I didn't get them in the story because we never actually like had a sit down interview, but just kind of told me on Twitter, like, I live on a street that's dark, or I live on a street that's busy, and these flags, you know, are, you know, I use them all the time because they make me feel safer and stuff. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. And then you also have the people who, you know, use the flags as sort of like novelty items, you know, like when they have guests in town, they go to the crosswalk and they'll parade through, you know, like a color guard member or something like that, you know. And so, yeah, those are about the three ways that it seems like people use the flags, like ironically, sincerely, or not at all.
You talked to Adam Cook, like his quote, he says, hey, why should we put the onus on the pedestrian? He says, should I wear a flashing light on my head? Should I carry a flag? Should I have to shoot a military flare in the air? Seems misguided. So what's next with these? I guess the city's going to proceed with more flags.
You know, I think the more flags would probably depend on, you know, if more people wanted to sort of volunteer to sponsor them, because how it works is the city sponsors, you know, like X amount, mostly in the downtown kind of central city area. Others are up around schools, and the city kind of subsidizes those as well. And then the vast majority of flags in Salt Lake cities are just like, you know, your neighbor contacted the city and decided that, you know, he or she wanted to sponsor the flag there. And so I know that since this article has come out, I've had people ask questions to me, like, how can I contact the city to put more crosswalk flags up? And so, you know, the city plans to promote the flags more. I don't know if they plan to actually sponsor more flags themselves, but then they also plan to, you know, dedicate the resources to go out and see which crosswalk flags locations are still being maintained, AKA, like, do they still have flags there? Do the sponsors still want to purchase those flags? Because they're about $2 a pop for flags, and you got six of them in there, so it can be a bit of a cost. So, yeah, that's what's next, basically, just kind of some maintenance and perhaps promotion.
All right, Peyton Harkins, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, of course.
Robert Gerke, we need to get to our underplayed stories of the week, but maybe your 30-second reaction to the story.
I thought it was a good story because if you walk around Salt Lake City, and you know how dangerous it is for pedestrians, I think our drivers just don't pay attention. And I think if these flags help, they help. I agree to some extent that we don't need to put the onus on the pedestrian, but physics kind of puts the onus on the pedestrian, because when a car is going that fast, it's much larger than the pedestrian. And so it makes sense to take some common sense, simple steps that you can. I think the one more crosswalk idea that, you know, Peyton kind of touched on are these blinking lights at the crosswalks, not the ones that overhang, but there's at least lights there. They're easier to see at night. And I think that's a sort of a middle ground option that I've seen to be very effective around the city. So, yeah.
All right. We just have 2 minutes for underplayed stories. We'll have to be quite brief, but I do want to get to this. Leah Larson, what's your underplayed story of the week?
So mine is about the Chinese balloon that kind of freaked everybody out and raised these national security concerns. Well, some people are calling, raising attention about security issues on the ground too, and foreign ownership of farms and the challenges that presents. And Utah, I guess, is in the top five for foreign owned land, and it doesn't really have any regulations to cap it. So,
okay. Check. All right. We'll check that out. Cordy Tanner, your underplayed story of the week.
I'm picking a story from Tribune reporter Emily Anderson Stern about syringe needle exchanges in Utah. They're legal, but participants can still get in trouble if they possess needles. And so there's this new bill making its way through the legislature to kind of remove that discipline in those programs.
Okay, sltrib.com to check that out. Peyton Harkins, your underplayed story of the week.
My underplayed story is from Colby Peterson. She has been doggedly in pursuit of documents after the Sugar House apartment fire from October, trying to figure out the cause of that fire. And so she got documents back and they narrowed it down to kind of two causes. They couldn't rule down arson, but they think it might have been these like small heaters that they had in the building for workers, or these like small electrical boxes here. Yeah, that might have caused the fire. So yeah, that was a big deal and we've gotten some answers.
Okay. Robert Gerke, 10 seconds for your underplayed story of the week.
You probably saw that the Utah Jazz had executed a big trade, hollowed out most of the team. Eric Walden did a nice piece on those who are left behind. It kind of reminds me of the book, The Leftovers, you know, that the team that is now kind of a fraction of what it once was as they kind of rebuild for the future. So I think it's worth checking out at sltrib.com.
Okay. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. And thanks to all of you who've joined us today. Thanks to everyone for listening.